Welcome to The Lob, your home of in-depth coverage and analysis by These Football Times, a movement of journalism you can trust. Each week, we endeavour to bring you the very best coverage of the game, exploring stories from the past and present with analysis by expert guests from around the world. Find more of our award-winning content online and in print. In the meantime, enjoy the podcast.
Whatever Thierry Henry achieves, his name will be forever associated with Highbury. And on the last day here, he has a hat-trick. The king of Highbury. It's getting better and better for Arsenal because the applause for Dennis Bergkamp has got even more intense because West Ham have gone 2-1 up against Tottenham at Upton Park.
And it's all smiles at the moment. It's all going Arsenal's way.
And that is it. Football is finished at Highbury for all time. And it's finished with a Thierry Henry hat-trick that has turned a 2-1 deficit into a 4-2 win. After 93 years, Arsenal say farewell in the grand manner. A million memories, and he's been responsible for so many. But the final one is of a victory.
Hello and welcome to another edition of the Lob podcast with These Football Times. My name is Stuart Horsfield, and tonight I'm delighted to say we have another edition of the magazine special. As you hopefully you'll all have been aware on social media, These Football Times have now given the One Club magazine treatment to the Red Half of North London. And Arsenal are the ones who have been selected for the treatment. And I'm delighted to say that we have probably a guest that I'm probably one of the most excited to have on the show. But before we get to our Arsenal specialist and special guest, I would like to introduce my two co-hosts on such an occasion. So first of all, to discuss the impending new magazine smell, Mr. Stephen Scragg. Stephen, how are you, sir?
Oh, we're very well, thanks, Stu. How's it going your end?
Well, as off air, it was a bit of a nightmare, but on air, it's going okay. Not too bad at all. Yourself?
Yeah, not too bad. Just, not going anywhere still at the minute. But, yeah, the sunshine has been brilliant today. And, yeah, back to doing keep yuppies in the garden with the kids.
Any more from... Because it was yesterday, right, that we spoke?
It was yesterday.
We did a podcast yesterday. Did you improve at all today?
They've improved. I'm impressed. The oldest girl, she managed to break a record today, and a close control is getting much better. So we've set a target for the end of the week, and she's going to double the amount she can do. That's the target.
Wow, that's no small amount of pressure you've just placed on her with.
She has placed it on herself. She has set herself a target. It's brilliant. Yeah, she's set herself this target, and she's got to go for it. And I believe she'll do.
Wow. Well, that's every football fan in the world, bar the Tottenham fans, that will have heard that. So next then, Mr. Gary Thacker. Gary, how are you, sir?
I'm good, thanks, matey. Had a really enjoyable day today. I've been sort of researching for my next book, and I've spent three and a half hours actually watching replays on YouTube of the Netherlands in the 1974 World Cup. Absolute rhapsody, mate. So I've had a great day, matey.
So you didn't bother to look up anything to do with Arsenal now, just still in that love affair with the Dutch of 74, yeah?
Yeah, I mean, Arsenal are fine, but they ain't all in the mate, are they? I mean, in fairness, you know, Bergkamp, who I wrote about for the mag, obviously a Dutch legend as well, but that was a great enjoyment for me. But, you know, I'm going to enjoy this conversation as well because, as a Chelsea fan, I don't have this sort of anti-other club bias that a lot of other teams have and other fans of other teams have, and you know, I can look at other teams and say, you know, they all have a special significance of their own, and you know, and Arsenal are very much in that same boat, and one of the things I remember from Arsenal, and you know, and you know, we may or may not touch on this later in the conversation, is I come from Warsaw in the West Midlands, and Warsaw had a famous FA Cup game against Arsenal in the 1930s when they were the best team in the country, and Warsaw was some mediocre Tottenham Army club running away in the Midlands, not bothering anybody, but beat Arsenal 2-0, not to make the FA Cup, but you know. Arsenal, a great club, and you know, massively successful, and so much just talk about in the magazine, and there's some fantastic articles in there as well.
There is, you know, as normal, we've got 14 articles in there. We look at the birth and the rise of Arsenal, the Irish Revolution. We cover George Graham, David Rocastle, Ian Wright, Tony Adams. The North London Derby, Highbury, obviously Arsene Wenger, Dennis Bergkamp. We look at the French connection. We look at Thierry Henry gets his own article, shall we say, which I'm sure our special guests will have plenty to talk about. We look at the lineage of great goalkeepers. We also look at Arsenal's influence on the pioneering of the women's game, which is excellent. Article on Santi Cazorla. We look at the evolution of the logo, legendary kits, as per usual. So, you know, it's another, you know, another wonderful magazine that's been put together with writers, artists, photographers. You know, with Omar, who's our editor, put it together, and which brings me nicely to our special guest. Now, our special guest is making his debut on the podcast, and we've tried for probably the best part of 2 years to coax him on, and it took an Arsenal magazine to finally convince him to come on. He's the sub-editor at These Football Times. He's the guy who is the genius behind the online series. So if anybody's just recently caught the Brits Abroad series, this is the guy to thank for it. Whenever we have our mini-series on there, I would say 99% of the time, but I'm going to say 100% of the time, this is the guy that you have to thank for it. Our guest tonight is Arsenal fan, These Football Times legend, and, by the way, no pressure on him, the writer of my all-time favourite article on These Football Times as well. But it's Mr. Will Sharp. Will, finally, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you very much. I'm delighted to finally be getting the monkey off my back and scoring my first podcast.
You see, once you've been on, though, that's it. It's like an addictive habit. You'll be knocking on the door for the next one as well.
Oh, yeah, I'm going to have to mark them off on the calendar, like each other Thursday.
So, obviously, it took an Arsenal magazine to convince you to come on. You know, we're gonna chat through people's, you know, we're gonna chat through some of the articles in detail. We're gonna look at Arsenal as a club. We'll have a look at their potted history. We'll, you know, we've all four of us have contributed articles to this magazine. But I suppose before we get into it, I'm just interested in what Arsenal means, obviously to you, Will, as an Arsenal fan, but to the other two guys as well. But I'll let you go first. So, Arsenal Football Club to you, what does it mean?
Yeah, it's interesting because I mean, I've listened to obviously so many of these podcasts, and quite often the expert, the person who is most knowledgeable about the club you're speaking about, most often, like a lot of fans, they have their paternal influence or a family influence. Growing up, my family wasn't particularly into football. Like I was brought up by my nan and my granddad, and neither of them had any interest in football initially growing up. So I sort of found my way into football sort of quite organically. I played it before I watched it, I think, and was just obsessed with it. And actually, I think the Arsenal podcast is quite a some time to admit this, but actually kind of grew up as a Manchester United fan, which not many people are going to be glad to hear about. But it was simply because football back then, like we never had any, there was never Sky or anything. So growing up in the early 90s, I was born in 92, and the only team that I remember seeing on TV was Manchester United. And like most guys my age, I was absolutely obsessed with David Beckham. So I'm actually not even sure that I supported Man U as much as I supported David Beckham. Like I did the haircuts. I had a Man U shirt with Beckham on the back. And I think it was, I don't know if it was New Millennium, New Club, or you know, United won the treble in 99, and I thought, oh, they've peaked. I might as well move on. But it was pretty much from the year 2000 that by then I was 8, and I feel like that was a good age to sort of start taking football seriously. And I don't think I ever sat down and thought, why am I supporting Man U? But I just didn't really care for them anymore. Like, I'd watch their games and there was just no real connection. So again, I don't think I set out to find another club, but I'd watch football more regularly on TV. I'd discuss it more with my friends. And I just became obsessed with Thierry Henry. And every time I watched Arsenal, there was obviously just the way they played. Everything about the club just seemed to exude a sort of a class that made me think, well, if I'm going to support somebody, I'm going to support these guys. And yeah, it was pretty much from there that obviously I dared to change my team once. I wasn't going to do it twice. And so, yeah, growing up, sort of leaving primary school, going into secondary school, becoming sort of 11, 12, 13 years old when Arsenal were hitting their, the Invincible era was incredible. It was there is no greater feeling in the world than going into school and like marching into the canteen in the morning to where everyone was waiting before the first bell went for the day, and being able to sort of strut because your team had won the night before. Like, the worst feeling in the world was going in knowing that your team had lost and then having to face up to the myriad of the fans of different clubs that were in the canteen. You had mostly United fans, Liverpool fans, Chelsea fans. Occasionally there'd be, I think there was two lads, like two brothers that supported Palace. There was like one Norwich fan, a handful of Charlton fans. And yeah, the best part was going in once you had won. And so, yeah, my sort of unintended decision to switch allegiance to support Arsenal came at the perfect time. And obviously the years have gone by and my love for Arsenal has intensified. And yeah, I don't know. It's hard to think of football or distance myself from Arsenal in a football context. Like everything I do in football, the way I write about football, the way I interpret football and watch it, is sort of now through an Arsenal lens. You watch other teams and you think how you sort of counter how they play with how Arsenal play. You watch players and you think, I wonder how they would fit into the Arsenal team. You watch managers and you think, I wonder if that's how Wenger would do it. Obviously, times have changed a little bit. The success sort of dried up as soon as it came into its own. But yeah, so it took a little bit of getting to Arsenal in terms of supporting them. But obviously, it's been 20 years since then and we've had lots of highs, lots of lows. But yeah, I adore Arsenal. The way they play, the ethos of the club. There's a lot to like about Arsenal. I think they're a club that potentially, it's easy for me to say, become biased, but I think potentially Arsenal are one of the easier clubs for so-called neutral fans to appreciate, because I think they just do a lot right, if you know what I mean. I'm sure Tottenham fans and United fans would disagree, but I think it's easy to love Arsenal.
Don't worry about the Tottenham fans. They switched off ages ago. Don't worry about them. They've already gone. They've already stopped listening. Well, that's exactly why. It's exactly why we've got you on. The passion, you can hear it in your voice, the love affair, the inner child, all the things that we enjoy listening to when guests come on. Your article for the magazine is
Thierry.
And obviously, as we go through the club's history, I have no doubt we'll be talking about him in more detail and why you chose him to write about.
For sure.
Stephen, obviously coming to you now. Obviously, when I suppose not like Will, a little bit like Will. There was no family influence on me either. Growing up in terms of supporting a team and part-time Hull City fan, but don't really have a die-hard allegiance. But when I think of Arsenal, I always think of that title decider at Anfield, that 2-0 victory, the Michael Thomas goal, and that's not why I've come to you now and asked you to talk about that in general. I'm just asking your sort of opinion and perspective on Arsenal Football Club.
Yeah. Oh, thanks for that, Stu.
You're welcome.
I've forgotten all about that. I'm just brewed all night. But no, Arsenal for me, they're just such a great historical English football club. You know, they're very unique, you know, down to the kit, the name. You know, absolutely adored Highbury as a travelling supporter, you know, Liverpool supporter, and getting to so many of those away grounds. And absolutely loved going to Highbury. And they're just such an evocative football club. You know, it's... And that's what they are to me. I mean, they weren't... When I was growing up, you know, Will grew up at exactly the right time to be impressionable about a free-flowing footballing Arsenal. But, you know, I grew up with that kind of, like, pragmatic Arsenal, you know. And then, you know, when Wenger came along and changed the whole ethos of the club and the way that the outlook of it and how they played the game, was remarkable. You know, I grew up on that 80s version of Arsenal, and then George Graham's version of it, which was, you know, just so horrible to play against, basically. You know, the people used to, the detractors used to say they were kind of like a more expensive version of Wimbledon, and it was massively, massively harsh. You know, they could play football. Every era of me growing up as a child and Arsenal being an Arsenal, they always had some kind of flair. You know, there was, whether it was Liam Brady, Charlie Nicholas, you know, Anders Limpar, there was, you know, David Rowcastle. There was always an element about Arsenal that had a bit of flair about them, and it was always, that was the thing for me for Arsenal, was that they always had that superhero of a player. You know, they worked hard, they were pragmatic, but then they always had this, you know, really not enviable star. You know, it wasn't a case of kind of like being, jealous of them having them. It was just a joy that, you know, you could watch them and watch this player blossom for them, and that was what Arsenal were for me. They, you know, Highbury was just such a distinctive ground. And, you know, even down to, I mean, I always loved the goalposts and stuff like that, because they were always individual from ground to ground. I think we've mentioned this on podcast before, the way that West Ham's would be so narrow with the ball, if hit at pace from kind of like the 12-yard area, would bounce back out the goal. And you could almost identify a football ground just by a picture of the nets. And Arsenal was another one of those. And I just absolutely love the place, and totally respect the club.
It's, I mean, obviously, you know, just talking about Highbury was is the article that I've written. You know, and for me, it's probably the, if someone asked me to describe or talk about it, I mean, I know they're changing now into the new design, but if anyone asked me to describe a typical English football ground, Highbury is the one. Is the one that I would point them to. I always thought it was just the most beautiful place. I mean, we all think football stadiums are beautiful, but to me, it was just such a beautiful place, and must have been a great place to go week in, week out to watch your football. Gary, so coming to you, you know, Arsenal Football Club. You mentioned at the beginning, you know, a Chelsea fan, so you know, London rival, but you know, and you're certainly magnanimous enough in all of these podcasts to acknowledge where greatness lies, or where greatness can be found in other clubs, other sides, other players. And I'm sure it's no different for you for Arsenal.
No, not really at all. I mean, I never really looked at Arsenal as rivals for our club or local rivals. I mean, probably because I live nowhere near North or West London anyway. I mean, there's three things about Arsenal that sort of stick in my mind. My dad... I mean, we're all sort of children of our generation, of our era, and I'm just about vaguely young enough, well, old enough, I should say, to remember Tottenham winning the double in the early 60s, but I can definitely remember Arsenal winning the double under, you know, Bertie, me and Don Howe, and, you know, that was sort of stuck in my mind for a long time. But my dad always used to say about Arsenal, my dad always called them the Dials. And I never understood why. He said, he told me, explained to me, that when they were formed originally, they were called Doyle Square, which always seems stuck in my mind. I mean, I don't know why, but it did. And the other thing about Arsenal that always resonated with me is the kit and the reason for the kit. And these two things get lost in time now. I don't know which one of the myriad stories of why Arsenal wear wide sleeves is true. But one of the favourite ones I have is we were two Nottingham Forest players who signed for Arsenal, apparently, a long, long time ago. And they, Arsenal hadn't got any kit, and they asked Nottingham Forest to supply them with some kit. And to differentiate between the kits of Forest and Arsenal, the Arsenal tore the sleeves out of their shirts that Forest had supplied to them. So they wore sleeveless shirts. And that's where the white sleeves come from. Now, I don't know if that's true, but I really, really hope it is.
It's, I mean, like you say, the part of the myth is, you know, of football clubs and stories, you know, the reasons why, you know, certainly some of the reasons why we fall in love with clubs, you know, and we so hope that some of these stories are true. But I think, you know, looking back at Arsenal, you know, there's the, and obviously originally, you know, they were south of the river. before they moved to North London. You know, they were founded as Woolwich Arsenal, part of the munitions factory. Then they moved north of the river. But I suppose, you know, Will, I think, I mean, for me, and you can correct me, because obviously, like I say, you know, you are the Arsenal fan, but it's, I suppose, you know, with Herbert Chapman, I think from sort of from then onwards, you know, he was the man who really seemed to really establish Arsenal as a premier, if you'll, it's not Premier League, but as a premier football club in England.
Yeah. Yeah, totally. And I think there's a nice sort of, I'm not sure if there's a symmetry, but there's a nice sort of pattern throughout history where Arsenal may have like a succession of managers that perhaps don't reach the heights of others, but sort of pave the way for later revolutions. So obviously you had Herbert Chapman was perhaps the originator, the first Arsenal manager to really make waves and to revolutionise the club. And then obviously you had the George Graham era, which followed on from a period of relative, like a lack of success. And then after Graham, you had a few sort of dull years before Wenger eventually was in charge. And I think it's nice that you can look back, and obviously no club is going to have a sustained success that lasts forever. No one's going to have decade after decade of constant success. But there are not only the trophies, but also the changes in formation or the pioneering aspects to their career or to their managerial career that then has that sort of ripple effect throughout the club's ongoing history. And I think it's really nice to be able to look back as far as Chapman's era and appreciate what it was that he did. I'm sure there are some clubs that can look back to maybe the 90s or the 80s, the 70s, and say, OK, that's when things really started to click into place, or it was when that manager or that player came into our club that we recognised that as a real moment of to sort of set the trend for future success. And I just sort of, as an Arsenal fan, I can really appreciate just how far back Chapman was and how great his impact was, how revolutionary he was, the things he introduced to the club that really set in motion a sort of a success that later generations would feel they were owed almost. Like you can tell that some clubs find success and it almost comes as a surprise because they've never tasted success before. And that's not to say that one club it deserves success more than another, but I think when there's a bit of a problem with present-day Arsenal fans, where they were so, particularly of my generation, where they grew up with Wenger, I think that was part of, it's a bit of a tangent, I think that was part of Wenger's problem in the later years. They were so accustomed to success initially that it became such an issue when he wasn't winning. But I think it's nice, and you can appreciate that Wenger won, and before him, Graham won, and before him, Chapman won. And it no longer feels strange when Arsenal win something because there's that established history, but there's a pattern for it. And I think that's something you can appreciate about a lot of clubs, and definitely that's something that I appreciate about Arsenal, is that there's a genuine history to the club and decades of success that came when, you know, your granddad's granddad was watching the same club that you were.
It's great, you know, listening to you talk there, you know, Will, about Herbert Chapman. And I remember as well, Stephen, the series that we did looking at managerial rivalries, and I think we started it in the 50s and went through to the 2000s. And obviously, Herbert Chapman was too early for that series, but he is one of those names, you know, as Will mentioned there, probably that, you know, really established the Arsenal reputation. And obviously, because of where the series started that we did in the 50s, he wasn't really someone who got any airtime for that.
Yeah, I mean, he's one of those great ones. He's just so synonymous. You get these managers that just, you know, they're so attached to a club. But he'd done with Huddersfield Town to help generate three successive league titles for them in the 1920s, and then to kind of be the genesis for Arsenal doing the same in the 1930s. You know, he lay a foundation, and it's like Shankly at Liverpool. It's like Busby at Manchester United. You know, he is, you know, it's not a Spurs night, but Arthur Rowe for Spurs. You know, there's an essence within each manager that kind of sets the blueprint for the football club to utilise through the future. It's like Barcelona with Cruyff. You know, it's Ajax and Michels. There's always some kind of you know, it's kind of like going back to the drawing board. And when it comes to going back to the drawing board, it tends to be those managers. You know, there will be some kind of basics that have been laid down by a manager like that are always a port of call. It's always to go back to and say what were, you know, the principles of the club. What does it mean to be part of this club? And Herbert Chapman laid those, you know, modern day foundations that are still there to this day. You know, you have the fabled marble halls of Highbury and that reverence that the club had that, you know, other managers kind of came in and embraced. You know, it went all the way through. Certainly Herbert Chapman's, you know, influence permeated the club all the way up to Arsene Wenger. You know, Wenger imbibed the history of the club and you know, everything that surrounded the supporters, the players. And I think that's just such an amazing thing to say that, you know, someone who came in the late 20s, mid to late 20s, you know, influenced so much of the 1930s, still had, you know, such an impression and hold on the club all the way into the 21st century.
For you, Gary, you know, Herbert Chapman, where does... I mean, I know it's, you know, impossible to rank managers and, you know, people like to, who was the greatest ever football manager and stuff, but do you think... I mean, obviously, Stephen and Will have both made a really good case for him, to be fair. But do you think, because of his time, because it was in the 1930s, perhaps he gets a little bit forgotten about, apart from, obviously, with Arsenal fans and keen historians of the game? Do you think he gets the due credit for what he achieved? And I suppose you can argue, as Stephen mentioned there, you know, what he did at Huddersfield before Arsenal, but I guess it's Arsenal that he's more synonymous with. But do you think he gets the credit he deserves?
Yeah, I guess probably not is the answer, because, as you mentioned, the passage of time always dims the memory. And, you know, people remember Shanks and Matt Busby and Nicholson, clubs that, you know, more recently in the sort of 60s and 70s and you know, going back to the 50s with Stan Collis at Wolves. So I suppose, yeah, there's always that sort of dimmed memory. But... you know, Arsenal are a club that always honours the past, you know, as well as the future. And, you know, the bust of Chapman inside the hall that, at Highbury was sort of, you know, a sort of an illustration of that. And I think, you know, history doesn't only teach you about the past, it also informs the future. And I think, you know, Stevie alluded to it just a few moments ago, that, you know, Wenger, when he arrived, picked up on that and the traditions that, that Chapman had set. And it's difficult to come in with a blank palette sometimes and trying to create a tradition. It's far easier to sort of understand, appreciate, accept and develop on an existing tradition. I think that's exactly what Wenger did. And, you know, perhaps, I wouldn't say he skipped several generations, but, you know, George Graham was massively successful, but there's lots of less savvy part of the squad at the time had many difficulties, which perhaps aren't worth mentioning at the moment. But, you know, he picked on the good things of the Arsenal tradition and developed from there. And, you know, Chapman was an important factor in that.
I'm quite interested. I'm going a bit off track now, Will, and I'm really sorry. I apologise, and I probably will do it more than once tonight as well. I'm really sorry. But in terms of, you know, just thinking about George Graham, and obviously you have Arsene Wenger, you have Herbert Chapman, and George, and I suppose I'm just interested. I know we will go through, like I say, the chronological history a little bit, but George Graham, to me, although he doesn't sit in the middle chronologically, because there's a big gap between Chapman before you get to George Graham, but he sort of seems to sit there, and I just wonder, you know, as an Arsenal fan, what your opinion of George Graham and his legacy is in comparison to someone like Wenger or Chapman.
I think obviously it's perhaps less significant in scale. I think obviously Wenger's legacy, his impact upon the club is immeasurable, and he not only achieved unprecedented success, but obviously laid the foundations for Arsenal, the club it is in 2020, perhaps not in the same the same, we don't perhaps retain the same level of competitiveness or boast the same sort of success that maybe we did 15 years ago. But I think you go to Arsenal today and everything around you, from the philosophy to the on-field playing style, to the players they recruit, to the way they treat one another, the way the club is, the image it sort of tries to portray and the way it's perceived in the media, that's pretty much all down to Arsene Wenger. So it's hard to then to compare another manager's impact to Arsene Wenger's, because not every manager is granted the opportunity to revolutionise a club, or any club, let alone a club of Arsenal's stature. But nevertheless, I think, like, I agree with Gary that Chapman perhaps isn't in as many conversations as he should be, simply because it was so long ago. I think you can't say enough about Arsene Wenger, but it would be hard to argue that he's underappreciated, given that there are enough people that will call him the greatest manager of all time. And there's a whole generation or two of Arsenal fans that grew up, myself included, who never knew Arsenal Football Club without Arsene Wenger as the manager. I mean, there are people online that, it's a tweet that I see fairly regularly, that there are people a little younger than myself that admitted that actually they thought that Arsenal were called Arsenal because their manager was named Arsene, which tells you the legacy that he had, or at least how long he was there. But yeah, I think Graham is underrated in that actually you can talk about Wenger's legacy, but perhaps Arsenal isn't the sort of club that somebody with the ability or the philosophy of Wenger would have, would go to, if Graham hadn't done what he did. And you can, you know, we talk about the bust of Chapman, and I was going to sort of say that I love the tangibility of that bust, because you walk into those marble halls, and if you're an Arsenal player or if you're an Arsenal manager, you walk in, you see that, and you think, right, who's that of and why is it there? Well, it's of one of our most successful managers, and that's what you have to look up to. That's what you have to try to strive for, because we're not alien to success, and this is the bar that's been set as many as, what now, 100 years ago. And then, you know, you have Graham's achievements, and you look back at 89 and you think, okay, you're competing for a league title now. Well, we've done that. We took it to the last day. We had a lead and we pretty much blew it. We almost blew the league title altogether. But that last day, we needed to turn up. We needed to defy the odds, turn up to the champions and beat them 2-0. They hadn't lost at home for however long, over a year, by two goals. Well, we're going to turn up and we're going to win 2-0. We're going to execute that plan perfectly. And so it creates a precedent by which future managers and future players simply have to succeed. And I suppose that sets you up for failure if you don't meet that bar. If you don't achieve the same level of success, then you sort of set yourself up for failure. But at the same time, you have to lay foundations for what's to come later. And I think Graham deserves an awful lot of credit for laying those foundations, for taking Arsenal to another level, which could then be built upon in years to come, as Wenger did.
The way you look at it there, Will, and you know, it's very articulate. You put it very articulately, which, you know, I thought you would as well. And I'm quite interested in this, because coming to you, Stephen, when I think about, well, my earliest memories of Arsenal are those three FA Cup finals that sort of spanned the late 70s, so 78, 79, 80, that's where Arsenal sort of drew my attention, if you like. And I know that, you know, your article, you know, sort of touches on those, certainly on the 70s, looking at the Irish connection. But I guess, you know, for people of our generation, that's, you know, this is, Herbert Chapman was too far in the past, and his children wouldn't understand. George Graham was yet to come, and obviously Arsene Wenger was yet to come. But for our generation, that was the sort of the Arsenal side that, or where we were first introduced to Arsenal Football Club.
Yeah, that's the Arsenal I grew up on. And that's why, you know, for me, it always jarred that, you know, Arsenal would have this, you know, 1-0 to the Arsenal jibe almost, and that the style of football would be not ridiculed, but brought into question, you know, because there was a pragmatism to it. But like I said earlier, there was also a flair to it. You know, it was a bit like Graham Taylor was a great one for it at Watford. You know, he would often be derided as a long ball coach when, you know, it was just such a lazy accusation, because, you know, he was a percentage player. But he had the fittest team in the country, and they played a rudimentary version of a pressing game. But then he would allow Fleur to be added to that as part of a structure. And Arsenal did exactly the same type of thing. They would have this strong template of a side, but with a nucleus of Fleur, and Liam Brady was the epitome of that. And then he would have kind of like Graham Ricks down the wing and Frank Stapleton, who could play football at the peak of it. So, this accusation was absolutely erroneous. They were a hard-working side. Yes, there was a pragmatism to it, but there was also, a flair and flexibility to it. And Terry Neill was an interesting manager, is that, he played for Arsenal. He went off and became player manager of Hull City. He managed Tottenham for a couple of years and then got the Arsenal job in succession to Bertie Mee, who'd been the double-winning manager. And he desperately wanted to create an Arsenal that was probably more in the image that people think of Tottenham of that era, of Hoddle, of Fear, of Ardiles, and them being London's Fleur side. And Neil really, he tried to coax Glenn Hoddle to Highbury. He looked at, there was an attempt to try and sign Diego Maradona, very young Diego Maradona. He did sign Charlie Nicholas. It was not for the want of trying to make this Arsenal side of his Fleur side. But what they did is they struck the perfect balance, because what he did in those early days is he brought in Alan Hudson, who, Gary will know all about from Chelsea, who could play the ball beautifully on the ground. They had the big star man up front in Malcolm McDonald. And the interesting thing being that with these two superstars in the side, they lose the 1978 FA Cup final to Ipswich, the most one-sided 1-0 FA Cup final ever, probably. But then they lose Hudson. Hudson's sold on. He falls out with Neil. He's sold on. Malcolm McDonald gets this horrendous knee injury that all but finishes his career. And out of kind of necessity, Neil alters his side somewhat. Brady becomes the all-encompassing number one. He doesn't have to share the stage for Fleur. And then Alan Sunderland is pushed up front as an emergency striker, takes to it like a duck to water alongside Stapleton, and suddenly they've got this wonderful, wonderful balance. And yes, this Irish component that is built around it by the Irish manager, Pat Jennings is added to it in 77. The wonderful story of Tottenham believing he was finished, that he was too old and over the hill. And, given the chance to sign for Manchester United and Aston Villa, he opted to go across North London to Arsenal. So he could stay at a club that was on the up, but also not uproot his family, and it was as much to do with that initially as anything. And then he went on to this wonderful, Indian summer of success, joining kind of like Pat Rice and Sammy Nelson, who were Northern Ireland internationals as well. And then you had the North-South Irish divide was knocked down at Arsenal, because you had Liam Brady from the South, as David O'Leary was, Frank Stapleton later, John Devine came along as well later on from the North. And they did. There were seven out of the 12 who were on duty for Arsenal in the 1980 FA Cup final, seven of them were Irish. And, it was just I think that was the Arsenal that I grew up on, was this side of Brady and Stapleton in particular, Jennings, great in goal, O'Leary at the back, this Irish spine through the middle of them. And just always there in cup finals. Grew up on that 79-80 season when they went for everything and came up with nothing. They lost the FA Cup final, lost the Cup Winners' Cup final, and even lost the last league game of the season. They played 70 games that season, and won't have changed the side all that much. They're probably only 15 or 16 players that will have played that season, and they lost the last game out of exhaustion. They went to Middlesbrough and lost the last game of the season to miss out on UEFA Cup for the following season. But this is the Arsenal that I grew up on, and I admired them greatly. Absolutely fantastic to watch as well.
Is it before I come to Gary, is that why you, I mean, obviously, when we decide, when we all decide or help decide, should I say, which club we're going to do next. And for people who are listening, it's never easy to decide which club we're going to do. If people only knew the discussions we had, is that how you decided what you were going to write about for this magazine? As in going back to your childhood?
Yeah, I think it was, because I think there was only two considerations, and as soon as it was mentioned, and I think any time we discuss the magazines, automatically your mind clicks in and you think that's what I want to write about. If we are going to do this magazine, that's the piece I want to write, and that was the one for me. It was either that or the other one I pulled around with was David Rocastle. So happy that Andrew Flint picked up the baton on David Rocastle's app. Absolutely adored David Rocastle. Wonderful player, great personality, and sadly missed as well.
You're right. It's funny, isn't it? When as soon as the magazines are sort of whatever the subject is for the magazine, straight away your mind goes to sort of one or two topics, and you just really hope that nobody else picks the ones that you do.
You've got to move quick. You've got to move quick.
It is one of them fastest finger first. Gary, I suppose, through the 70s, 80s, there's a lot of flair players. I mean, as Stephen mentioned there, you have a couple of ideas. I seem to have got into the habit of writing about football stadiums, but I adore football stadiums. Like I say, I think they're beautiful. I can find the beauty in any football stadium. My other idea was looking at Charlie Nicholas, as I had done as part of the Celtic magazine and the Mavericks there. But I guess, sometimes Arsenal can get this reputation of, the 1-0 to the Arsenal. But there are, as Will and Stephen kind of mentioned a little bit, there is this penchant for flair players. And certainly as we go into the new millennium, that becomes even more evident. But they have always been there at Arsenal, haven't they?
They definitely have, mate. And, we took a bit of magazines in getting in there for the ones the subject of wants. And, I tended to plump for the Maverick players, and Jimmy Johnston I did with the Celtic mag, and on the Arsenal one, Burkhardt. I don't know if I was first through the tape to get through by Omar, but if I wasn't first, I was probably second. But Arsenal got a fantastic reputation of bringing players in that, and as Stephen mentioned earlier about Liam Brady, and it's a good example, but they've got a number of players down from Scotland. I mean, I'm old enough to remember Peter Marinello, who they brought down from Scotland, who sort of struggled with the bright lights of London, but an exceptional footballer. And, he could have and should have been an exceptional player for Arsenal. Charlie George, a London guy, obviously not important from anywhere else, but a Maverick player who, when they won the double, he was an exceptional player and big feature in Nick Hornby's book, Fever Pitch. If you haven't read the book about Arsenal, you would need to read the book. Probably the best football book ever written. But also, as well as Charlie George, I say Charlie Nicholas, Bergkamp, Henry, Brady, Ian Wright. There's so many players who weren't in a pattern. They didn't fit a pattern. They created a pattern. And, Arsenal had this reputation of bringing... When you look back, and you perhaps don't realise they had it, but they did. When you look back and see these players throughout the years that they brought into the club who were not 1-0 to the Arsenal, that as Stevie quite rightly says, it's a 0-1 reputation that they have. But they had so many flair players who entranced, enchanted, entertained, and were successful for Arsenal as well in so many ways. But the Arsenal fans love these, much as so many clubs fans, we all like to have this guy who makes us sit on the end of our seats, and Arsenal had so many of those players over the years.
I suppose, as you mentioned that, you mentioned Bergkamp there, Gary, and obviously Dennis Bergkamp is the subject of your article, and you're right, you could look at Charlie Nicholas, obviously Thierry Henry was taken, but Liam Brady, you can rattle off these players. For you, Bergkamp, where does he rank in Arsenal's greatest ever players?
He's near the top. He's absolutely near the top. And he didn't get the goals that Henry got, but Henry wouldn't have got the goals he got if it wasn't for Bergkamp. Arsenal wouldn't have been the club they were if it wasn't for Bergkamp. People think it's easy to sort of point the belief that Bergkamp came because of Wenger. Actually, Wenger came after Bergkamp. Bergkamp was signed by Bruce Rioch. And but he created a revolution in the club. And so many players, in my article, I've got quotes from Tony Adams and from Ian Wright, who say about the difference he made. And when he first arrived at Arsenal, it actually been a failure at Inter Milan. He moved to Inter Milan from Ajax, which was a terrible move for him. A system of football totally alien to what he'd been playing Ajax, and he got slaughtered in the press. And a couple of quotes that I used in the article. I'm just going to just reel them off here. Dennis Bergkamp is a 7.5 million striker playing like a player who costs 75 pence. Now he needs Bruce Rioch to give him a rocket to get his finger out. That was Mark Lawrenson. And Stuart Pearce, actually, after a 1-1 draw at Highbury in the fourth game of the season after Bergkamp signed, famously described Bergkamp as a total waste of money. Now, those quotes didn't go down very well over time, gentlemen. I wonder how long they took to regret those things they said, because Bergkamp was one of the greatest signings of foreign signings into British football, who made a difference not only at the club that he signed for, but also in football in England, British football generally.
I mean, you know, Will, you talk about sort of turn into Arsenal Football Club. You know, you started off, I suppose, as a David Beckham. I won't call you a Manchester United, an ex-Manchester United fan. I'll call you a David Beckham fan, because that is what you said you were. To be fair, I'm also a fan who follows or supports players, follows players rather than the team. So I can fully buy into that. I mean, obviously, you've had, you know, more or less a front row seat, and I suppose what I'm interested in. This is going to seem like a really big question, I'm really sorry, and I would like to try and break it down, but I've tried and I can't. So, this whole French Revolution, Vieira, Petit, Henri, Wenger, I mean, you know, I suppose it's around the time, I guess, that you started to support, Robert Pires as well, that you started to support Arsenal, I'm interested in what it was like, as an Arsenal fan, to have this almost seeming conveyor belt, this influx of talent from the same country that just seemed to produce the most beautiful football, albeit, I'm not saying Manchester City produce a better brand now, but I do like watching Manchester City. But up until then, you know, Arsenal were producing probably the best football we'd seen in the Premier League.
Yeah, well, I mean, it was wonderful because I definitely don't remember seeing it at the time, but looking back, I can recall the headline from one of the Red Tops that said Arsenal win the World Cup in 98, because obviously Petit and Vieira and Henri were so instrumental. But yeah, there was a palpable sense that Arsenal weren't a particularly English club. Like, I mean, Stephen talks about the Irish influence that would have passed me by, obviously long before my time. But Arsenal were so attractive to French players. And it was sort of a self-fulfilling prophecy whereby we had the best French players. So because France were one of the best football-playing countries, as you say, this conveyor belt of phenomenal talent that seemed to find its way to Arsenal, whether by accident or by design, they would then play extremely well. They would win things. They would then set the example for other French talent who would then seek to come to Arsenal. And, I mean, you can see it as Josh Butler covers in the magazine. You see this thread throughout Arsenal's history that has now gone on for over 20 years, whereby that precedent has allowed players to come, even to this day, where you see the signing of players like Pepe and Lacazette, who they still speak of those French influences. I think it was literally 2 days ago that Paul Pogba said that he grew up as an Arsenal fan. And I think Arsenal, France was as ubiquitous in the Arsenal team as Arsenal seemed to be in France. And as I said, it was sort of self-fulfilling in that one would feed the other. And I think Arsenal got nothing but success from that. Obviously, there were some players that it turned out slightly better than others. There were a lot that came over that didn't quite fulfil that promise, which I suppose is just the curse of the footballer, isn't it? You don't always live up to the potential that you have. And I'd have absolutely loved the likes of Jeremy Aliadier to follow in Henri's footsteps, because it certainly seemed like he had the potential to be able to make maybe not a similar impact, but an impact nonetheless. So they didn't all work out. But yeah, it was it was brilliant at the time to watch them come through and to just to add something different. There wasn't the abundance of foreign talent that was that's in the game today. And it was, if nothing else, it was just interesting to watch. It was great to see these footballers come and sort of create their own culture within the club and actually make it a culture of success. I did read some quotes recently that said actually they kind of formed a bit of a faction, and occasionally their sort of their typical kind of French arrogance sometimes erred on the wrong side of things, and they would blank other players at the club. But I think also that was gradually eked out when they realised that it wasn't perhaps conducive to the success that they all craved. And I don't think, obviously, that didn't last forever. And you know that when it came to like the 2003, 2004, 2005, there wasn't a team as close-knit as Arsenal was, or a team as competitive on the training field as there was. So there was going to be bust-ups anyway. And I think perhaps the French divide may have fed into that slightly. But yeah, I think obviously it was such a net positive, the influence they brought, the style they brought. And Arsenal are still reaping the rewards today. As I said, they don't maybe have the success that they had 20 years ago, 15 years ago. But the fact that we can still attract players, the fact that we can finish out of the Champions League places for 3-4 years and then attract some of the world's best talent who say, oh yeah, like, of course I want to go to Arsenal Football Club. I grew up supporting Arsenal Football Club. They had some of the greatest talents that my country have ever produced. I think we're incredibly fortunate to have been able to lay that foundation that has then allowed us to create such an appeal for players today.
It's fascinating, as you say that there, the ability to attract. I mean, for me, Aubameyang, I think, is a wonderful, wonderful striker. You know, one in the top three in the Premier League. I think, it's, you know, for Arsenal to still be able to attract players of that calibre, as you say, speaks volumes for the club. I'm just gonna speak to the other two guys a sec, Will, because I want their opinions on that side. I mean, obviously, you know, we need to touch on the Invincibles, and then I'm gonna come back to you about Henry, because I know you've written your article on Thierry Henry. For me, he is the best player that's played in the Premier League. I think he was glorious to watch. But Stephen, for you, you know, the Invincible side, the Arsenal of the early, you know, as Will mentioned there, 3-4-5. You know, there's no denying that the greatness of that side.
Oh, they were brilliant. I'm just so happy that they played that football at Highbury as well, because although it wasn't quite the end, it was a fitting kind of tribute for that football ground, for that football to be played out there. You know, they were wonderful. They played football in an outstanding, fluid manner. And, you know, you get those occasions where those eras, passing eras, where the football is just so joyous, you know, and it doesn't matter what the team is playing that, apart from Man United, maybe. Yeah, if you know, it could be the Dutch, it could be absolutely anyone, you know, it's like Barcelona with Messi. You know, there is just such a joy to be had by witnessing a football team at the peak of their powers, playing in such an apparent carefree manner.
Gary, you know, your perspective of this side. You know, you again, you know, Mourinho comes. Is it? I think 2004. I think, is it Mourinho arrives at Chelsea?
Right, mate. Yeah.
Yeah. So I mean, you know, you have, you know, really, you know, probably one of the great Premier League sides playing, you know, some of the most attractive football. And it doesn't matter who you support, you know, that Arsenal side. And I think, you know, we've mentioned it already, that every neutral fan is who you wanted to watch. You know, match of the day, it was always, you know, wanting to watch Arsenal. And like I say, just sometimes you have to just hold your hand up and, like I say, acknowledge greatness. And that Arsenal side had that.
Yeah. I mean, okay, so when you're a fan of a club, you want a guy who's going to deliver trophies, and Mourinho delivered trophies for us, and you know, won successive championships, and then, you know, went on to success afterwards. But you also want to play with a certain style. You want to play with a joy. You want to be entertained. You want to you want to celebrate the way your team performs. Now, even when Wenger's team weren't winning, they were still entertaining. They still had a certain panache about them. You know, any team who had players the likes of Bergkamp, Perez, Henry, of course, you know, Overmars, and so many other players who, you know, who were it's difficult to say they were entertainers because they were successful as well. They weren't just entertainers, but they played a fluid type of football that was so nice to watch. And, you know, sometimes they didn't win trophies, although they did win plenty of trophies. And, you know, my Chelsea team almost bullied them out of games sometimes. But, they, you know, they were entertainers. And there's a quality about that that's important. And, you know, Johan Cruyff said about this 1974 World Cup that, you know, we didn't win the trophy, we're the best team there. And there's a certain truth about that, about Arsenal, when they didn't win the league, but they were a great team to watch as well.
Coming to you, Will, I suppose, you know, the figurehead, the focal point, whatever you want to call it. But like I said to you earlier, you know, for me, the greatest player of the Premier League era, Thierry Henry, you know, he's someone that you mentioned at the beginning. He's somebody that you chose to write your article on. You know, your opinion, your perspective, your thoughts on a wonderful, wonderful footballer.
Well, it was always going to be Henry. It had to be Henry for me. As soon as we sort of got the agreement on Arsenal as being the next club, it had to be Henry. And I've been wanting to write about Thierry for literally years. There's a fantastic piece already on the site. I think it might have been Matt Gould who wrote it. And because it was so good, there was never room for another Henry article. The amount of times I'd sort of finish one article and go, okay, well, the next one's going to be Henry. And I'd sort of try and find the tournament or find the goal or whatever it was, a new, fresh angle. But to be honest, I didn't. There's quite a lot of players that I'll go, okay, they're a great player, but actually it was this succession of games that I really liked, or it was this facet of their personality, or this season that I really liked. But it was so difficult to find a unique perspective on Henry, because I just wanted to write about how I thought he was the greatest player. I mean, like, obviously, I can admit that Lionel Messi is... Like, I don't think Thierry Henry is the greatest player to have ever played the game. But in terms of players that I've watched and just thought, wow, on a day-to-day basis, you know, I think only Cristiano Ronaldo rivals Henry for the title of the greatest player of the Premier League era. But even then, I think part of Henry's... The superstar that Henry was. Well, he wasn't just a flash in the pan. Obviously, Ronaldo went on to do phenomenal things elsewhere, and if he'd stayed for longer, I think he could have rivaled Henry, but that's, for me, why Henry gets the nod as the greatest ever Premier League player, because he did what he did on such a vast scale, on such a... on a game-by-game basis for years. And so when it came to writing the feature about Henry, there was sort of two things that I wanted to communicate, which was, firstly, just the things he did. I mean, I would say the goals he scored or the games he decided, but there was just so many small moments. There were goals. There were the hat-trick against Liverpool that turned the game at Highbury when it looked as if the unbeaten run was at risk of collapsing. There was the flick, swivel and volley against United. There was the goal against Tottenham, running the entire length of the pitch and sliding on his knees. There was the hat-trick against Roma. There was the demolition of Inter Milan. There was the time Henry took a quick free kick, scored it, was told to take it again by the referee, and scored it again, and looked at the ref and said, well, is that good enough? There was just so many moments where you look at Henry and you think, he's doing things that no other player can do, or that other players don't do nearly as frequently as he did. But the other side of that was, I don't just want to mention the moments, because what's as important is the way that I know he made Arsenal fans and Arsenal players feel. And that was, rather fittingly, invincible. When Henry was in your team, you felt absolutely unbeatable. And I needed to communicate that that feeling, because it was just the confidence and the swagger, that sort of Gaelic swagger of, well, I'm going to beat you because I know I'm capable of it, and there's nothing I want to do more than beat you, so I'm going to go and do it. And there weren't many occasions where the defender or the pack of defenders got the better of him. Like, actually, I noticed today was, I saw on Twitter that it's today marks 16 years since Henry scored four in the 5-0 win at home to Leeds during the Invincible season. And I thought, oh, this is perfect, actually, because those four goals kind of encapsulate everything that I adored about Thierry Henry, like, just so perfectly. Like, the four goals, for instance, if I can just go through them quickly.
Yeah, of course.
The first one, he was played in by Gilberto Silva. He looks a mile offside, and the Leeds backline stop. They hold their hands up, but obviously he's onside. He's a mile clear of them already. And you can just see the panic on their faces, thinking, oh, my God, we're never going to catch him. We wouldn't have caught him if we were neck and neck with him, let alone, you know, 5 yards behind us already. He charges forward and just slots it past Paul Robinson with his weak foot to put Arsenal 2-0 up. Then there's the second goal, is a penalty, and it's the most nonchalant Panenka you'll see. It's the fact that he doesn't even break his stride. He approaches it at a jog, like quite a fast jog, and then doesn't slow down for a moment, just dinks it straight down the middle and carries on his jog to celebrate. Then you've got the hat-trick goal where he's played in and he slides it past Robinson in that, like, quintessential Henry style, where he opens his body up and sort of finesses it with his right instep past Robinson. And then the fourth goal is almost a carbon copy of the third, where he's played in again, but he's not yet behind the defence, so he outpaces the defence. And then as he's about to shoot, Gary Kelly, I think it is, sort of just has a little nibble at him, just thinks, no, I'm not going to let him get another one. So he thinks, I'm too far away from the ball, I'm just going to get his ankle, I'm going to get his heel, whatever I can clip. So he clips him, and Henry starts to fall, and then somehow just puts it in anyway. He's falling over, but he still manages to finesse it past Robinson. And the look on his face is like, yeah, I've done it again. And I can imagine that being absolutely infuriating if you're not an Arsenal fan. But obviously watching that as an Arsenal fan, just thinking, this is probably the best feeling in the world. Because not only am my team winning, there's not an element of surprise to it. I'm not in the slightest bit surprised that we're winning, because we've got Thierry Henry up front. And he's just going to keep doing this, because that's what he was made to do. And so obviously the opportunity to write about Henry at length and dedicate 3,000 words to this, everything I'm rambling about now, is just, this is why I love Thierry Henry, because he was absolutely the greatest. And yeah, there was never anyone else that I was going to write about.
I think what you've probably done is actually convinced me that we should have a one player magazine, let alone a one club magazine. Just stay with you a sec, Will. I mean, Thierry Henry, you know, developed into a truly world class footballer. And I'm just interested on your opinion as to Wenger's influence. You know, you talk about that absolute belief and that absolute confidence. But for me, and what I can remember, he didn't arrive at Arsenal with that arrogance. It sort of took, you know, sometimes you have, you know, the perfect manager, you know, gets the perfect player, you know, and they create these perfect moments. And I suppose I'm just interested in your opinion on Wenger's influence on the development of Henry.
Yeah, I think it was, well, I mean, obviously it was enormous, not only because he brought him to Arsenal, but because he knew him from his Monaco days, and was the man that gave him his chance at Monaco, which he gleefully took. I will obviously talk a bit more about Wenger's influence on Henry, but I just love the sort of fate, the scenario that took Henry to Arsenal. It's something that I don't speak about an awful lot in the article, because I think people know it, but it was just the fact that John Hartson had moved on to West Ham. Wenger had replaced him with Nicolas Anelka for £500,000. A lot of eyebrows were raised at the time, people thinking, we've got this young lad from Paris Saint-Germain who's really not going to cut it in the Premier League, arrives, scores a bucketful, leaves again to 2 years later to Madrid for something like £22.5 million, I think it was. And Wenger looks like an absolute genius. But then, obviously, the money's all well and good. Anelka was a success. We won the double with him, scoring goals up top. But who are you going to replace him with? And then Wenger plumps for this another young Frenchman that he knew from his Monaco days. And then Henry goes something like 9 games without scoring his first goal. And everyone's thinking, well, why have you done that? It's easy to look on past successes. But, I mean, you can't get it right every time. And we're not really sure what it is you've done this time. But, yeah, once Henry started scoring, there was just no end to it. And I think not only was it Wenger's choice to play him up front at Arsenal, but obviously it was his decision to play him at Monaco. And it was actually then the first time that he decided to instruct Henry not only to be a striker, but to use that left wing as an advantage rather as a hindrance. It was the left wing that obviously Henry sort of floundered on at Juventus. But it was no surprise that he played there, because he had played there at Monaco. He had cut in from the left to such success at Monaco, and obviously he rediscovered that at Arsenal. But Henri did say that he felt as though he needed to relearn the craft and sort of rediscover his scoring touch and relearn everything it was to be a successful striker, because of the Juventus years and because of the relative age it took him to find his first Arsenal goal that he eventually got against Southampton. He did feel as though he had to sort of reinvent himself. And I think having someone like Wenger, that sort of that confidant, that person you can trust, a father figure who would only then grow in terms of significance together, I think had it been anyone else, there may have been a slight feeling of, I'm really letting this guy down. Like, he signed me to be the man, to be the striker up top, to deliver the success that previous strikers have laid the foundations for, and I'm not doing it. But I don't think there was ever a time, he may have started to doubt himself perhaps for a short while when the goals dried up, but I don't think there was ever a moment where he looked at Wenger and thought, he doesn't have faith in me. And I can only imagine how rewarding that was and how encouraging that was to have someone that you can look to and think, well, I'm going to be okay. I'm going to find those goals again, because he has absolute faith and confidence that I'm going to find those goals again. And obviously, I think without Wenger, we may never have seen the Henri that we came to love.
It's great. It's a great sort of segue in. I mean, you know, Stephen, again, going back to the manager series, you know, and you know, Will points out brilliantly there, you know, sometimes spotting talent is one thing, having patience with that talent, the belief in that talent, when there's no immediate return, but knowing as a manager that you've made the right decision and you've got, you know, you've got the right player, it's just about patience. And I suppose, there's, you know, where do you begin to talk about the various legacies, if you like, or the highlights of Arsene Wenger's career at Arsenal?
I think with Wenger, you have to step away from what he won, in a way, is that it's his entire legacy. You know, he changed the face of English football, you know, as much as Alex Ferguson did. You know, when Wenger arrived, you know, he wore glasses when he first arrived, and it lent this kind of, for the media, a very ready-made, here comes, you know, Professor Wenger. You know, there was a very kind of like mocking welcome for him, almost. You know, it was still an era of, you know, Premier League teams, top flight English teams being managed by British and Irish managers. You know, Aston Villa had Joseph Venglos in charge for a season when Graham Taylor took the England job. And he was a fantastic coach, but suffered massively just for simply not being British and not being given an opportunity to show what he could do. And he lasted a season, and it was an inconsistent season, and he went off, you know, elsewhere. So when Wenger came kind of 5 years later, you understand it's still that same landscape. But he changed that. You know, he altered that within 2 years, you know, to go and win the double in 97-98. You know, he wasn't there during the summer months of 96-97. He only took over after a couple of games from the start of the season. The fact that he'd come directly from Japan as well brought scornful comments. But then his football just started to speak for itself. And very quickly, the perception of him and his style of football changed, you know, and the fact that he altered the Arsenal way, you know, from that George Graham, Bruce Rioch, hard-working, percentage-playing, pragmatic, with a dash of skill. You know, that approach that Arsenal had for so long was just, you know, blown out the water. You know, Arsenal had notoriously had that wage structure as well. There was a conservatism about Arsenal in so many ways. But this was a new Arsenal. Very, very quickly, it was a new Arsenal. And to be able to... And it seemed like he had, you know, the entire kind of French football field to pick these players from, to bring these players in from, to know, to be able to pick up on an Elka and to sign Petit, who he worked with, and he just exuded this intelligence that I think English football just wasn't used to, and it wasn't quite prepared for. But it, very quickly he was embraced. You know, he just changed the way that so many people looked at how football should be played and how it should be embraced.
Gary, I suppose, you know, we mentioned Mourinho, you know, and his arrival there, and I think that one of the great things about Wenger is that, you know, he competed against Ferguson, he's competed against Mourinho. You know, his time at the club has, you know, has seen him come up against, you know, some of the best managers that, you know, the English football has ever seen. And, you know, as Stephen's mentioned there, more and more managers coming in from the continent, coming in from abroad, and obviously Wenger's one of them, but one of his legacy is that he went toe-to-toe with, you know, with some of the greatest managers in the game.
Didn't he just? Now, here's the scenario to consider for a moment. Mikel Arteta has left Arsenal, and the Arsenal are going to appoint a new manager, and it's nobody you've ever heard of. They've gone to the Japanese league, the J1 league, and they've taken a manager who managed Monaco in France for a while, and didn't really win anything particularly, although they had a decent team. And they're appointing to manage one of the biggest clubs in England. You mentioned earlier about spotting talent and how important that is. David Dean could do that. And didn't he just do that when he appointed Arsene Wenger to become Arsenal manager? This is a guy when he turned up and he had that first press conference. He sat there like... we were saying Arsene who, and I've had a quote from Tony Adams who said, you know, at first I thought, what does this Frenchman know about football? He wears glasses, looks more like a school teacher, he's not going to be as good as George Graham. Does he even speak English? Well, obviously he did, and he knew an awful lot about football. And when Arsene Wenger retired afterwards, Adams tweeted, thank you for everything, Arsene, move over Herbert, Arsene Wenger, the greatest Arsenal manager. And that's probably not an overstatement, because this guy came in from as an unknown. He had no collateral to bring with him. He had no name recognition, and he transformed Arsenal from being a team that was sort of, you know, the 1-0 to the Arsenal, into being one of the greatest entertaining teams of the modern era. And as you say, he went toe to toe with Ferguson and Mourinho, and came off better on a number of occasions. The invincible season, you know, to quote just one. So Arsene Wenger, but I think it's important to remember as well that Arsene Wenger wasn't just good for Arsenal. Arsene Wenger was good for football, and he dragged out the outdated, outmoded attitude of English football into the modern era.
Hear, Gary. I would agree. I think, you know, I think his influence on English football has been, well, it's almost irreplaceable by any other manager. You know, I think you're absolutely right. I think there's a pre-Wenger and then a post-Wenger, if you like, with regards to English football and the development of the game here.
Definitely.
I think for any Tottenham fans that we might even have remotely managed to keep, you might want to skip to the end. I'm going to ask you about North London derbies, fellas. I'm going to say that they're probably all going to end in positive results for Arsenal, but if there's any brave Tottenham fans who are still listening, you never know. There might be one that results in a Tottenham win, although I highly doubt it. Certainly not from Will anyway. But for you, Will, do you have a favourite game against the North London nemesis?
I mean, it's going to be hard to choose one that isn't the one where Arsenal won the league at White Hart Lane. But, you know, actually, there's two that stand out. There's the 4-2 win of December 2018. That one's a bit bittersweet now, because at the time it seemed to be a real sea change, like a real trigger moment for the sort of the Emery reign. That win with Aubameyang opening the scoring, Eric Dier and Kane score to turn it around. Then the Arsenal comeback begins. Aubameyang gets his second. Lacazette scores fairly late on. Then Torreira scores. And that was obviously the goal that ended with Torreira ripping his shirt off at the corner flag. and sort of diving to his knees and being mobbed by the players. And I mean, I wasn't there, but the reaction in the stadium, you could tell on TV, was something absolutely euphoric. And it genuinely seemed at the time, quite sadly to reflect upon now, that this was the change. This was where Arsenal were going to take off. And so unfortunately that didn't happen. So that has sort of dulled the luster of that match a little bit. But yeah, aside from the league winning game at White Hart Lane, it's actually the 3-0 win at home in October 2009 stands out for the Fabregas goal that I'm sure you'll remember, where Van Persie opened the scoring in the 42nd minute and then Tottenham kicked off. Fabregas nicked possession back immediately from the kickoff. I think it was a slightly wayward pass or an underhit pass, and Fabregas nicked in, just bombed forward. Didn't so much as take it past people, just caught them cold, bundled through, and then managed to score. And actually, again, I was watching it on TV, and the cameras barely even caught it. I think they were watching the Arsenal fans and Arsenal players celebrate. They managed to get back, and Arsenal was the TV. Sky was still showing the replay of the previous goal, and they managed to switch it back, and the normal camera view only showed Fabregas putting the ball in. And it wasn't until they got a different camera, an alternate view, that they actually managed to catch the kickoff to show you the entire goal. And I think, I mean, I've certainly never seen that happen any other time with Arsenal, especially seeing. I mean, there's nothing better than scoring, watching a goal scored against Tottenham. But the idea that you can score, and then while the Arsenal fans are celebrating and the Tottenham fans are cursing, your captain then goes and grabs the ball and smashes another one home before anyone even realises that the first goal is over. I think there's something really special about that, and that definitely stands out because, there aren't many North London derby goals that are quite as unique as that.
Well, I think that's done it well. I think that's finally got rid of the last of any Tottenham listeners that we might have had.
I shan't say good riddance, I won't.
That's all right. I'm not even cutting that either. Stephen, obviously, you know, a keen watcher and participant in Merseyside derbies. You know, I'm sure you can appreciate a good old North London derby.
Oh yeah, yeah. I mean, that's the thing with the derby matches. It's that edge. It's that, you know, it can change from city to city, country to country. It's that undeniable edge to them. And yeah, watch many a fantastic North London derby. But for me, it was a cluster of them. There was a trio of them in 87, and it was the League Cup semi final, and the first leg Spurs went to Highbury and won 1-0. It was the Spurs of David Pleat. It was Clive Allen scored the goal. The season he scored 47. They got to the cup final. They were in with him with the title, certainly up until Easter, I think it was. And it looked like, you know, there were shouts of a possible treble. And this game at Highbury, Spurs went and won. And then the second leg at White Hart Lane about 3 weeks later. Spurs again scored the first goal. It looked all over, and legend has it, and I don't know how true it was, that ticket information for the final was put out over the tannoy at half time. And then second half, Arsenal came back into it, scored two goals, put it level on aggregate. And it wasn't the away goal rule, it was just the aggregate score. And it took the game to a replay. And again, Spurs, I think, had the lead. Again, Clive Allen, who at the point, I think he seemed to be the only player scoring for Tottenham at the time. But no matter how talented that side, because it was Hoddle in his last season, Ardiles was still, Chris Waddle. It was a very talented Tottenham side. But then again, Arsenal came flooding back, and Rocastle scored this absolutely electric equaliser. And this replay was happening kind of like 3 days after the second leg, and I think there was a league game they played against each other as well within that vicinity of games. And then I think it was Allenson that climbed from the bench to get this winner for them, possibly in extra time. And it was under the floodlights, and it was still that era when, you know, a live game on the television, which was much more prevalent by then, but it still felt like an occasion that, you know, your mates would turn around and say, "Oh, I'm going out," or whatever. Well, no, there's a game on the telly. So you'd sit in and watch it, and these three games were just, you know, absolutely incredible. Although Arsenal went on to beat Liverpool in the League Cup final, you know, it was just absolutely captivating. Those games have always lodged in my mind, and it was one of Rocastle's finest nights.
I mean, you know, for you, Gary, I mean, Stephen Pitt's great pictures, doesn't he, of game. You can almost feel like you're back there watching it. You know, for you, Gary, do you have a favourite North London derby?
Yeah, I mean, you're right, Steve, just paid fantastic pictures of games. And I always feel a bit cheated about derbies because as a Chelsea fan, we don't really have one. You know, Tottenham is a fairly close game for us, and that's probably the nearest we have to a derby. We want to beat somebody. Otherwise, it's Fulham, and, you know, no disrespect to Fulham, but, you know, they're not in the same league. So, you know, I'm always envious of, you know, people like Stevie with the Merseyside derby and Will with the Northland derby. And my missus, who a Wolves fan, and all the family are, you know, and they're desperate for the baggage to get promoted to the Premier League. They say so they can take the 6 points off them, but I think it's more important that they beat them occasionally. but, you know, I mean, so I'm a fairly neutral observer of derbies, but if I'm going to pick one of the North London derbies, it'd have to be the one in 2004 when Arsenal went to White Hart Lane and won 5-4. I mean, you know, in a derby, to win in your opponent's backyard is probably the best way to win a derby. And to do it by scoring five goals in a game that was sort of fluctuating. One at half-time, and then the goals were sort of pinging around like a basketball game. It must have been a fantastic game to watch, especially if you're an Arsenal fan. So if I'm going to pick an North London derby, I'll pick that one.
That was quite brief, that, Gary. I think the Tottenham fans can actually come back and listen a little bit earlier. I suppose, you know, before we go, guys, you know, obviously, you know, it, we're talking really about Arsenal Football Club, and, you know, it's because we've written the magazine, you know, and we've chatted for, you know, the best part of an hour and a quarter already. You know, there's so much to talk about, you know, with regards to the history of Arsenal Football Club, the players, the great games, the managers. But, you know, I suppose the last thing that I suppose I want us to touch on, you know, and obviously I'll start with you, Will, and that's, you know, Wenger was there for so long, you know, and there's a whole generation of Arsenal supporters that don't know what it was like to ever be managed by anybody else. You know, Mikel Arteta has now got the job, who is somebody that I think will do really well. You know, I thought he was great. He must have learned so much under Guardiola. You know, he was a great player at the club. But I suppose, you know, final thoughts really from all three of you is where do you see Arsenal going from here?
I'm not sure I would. I'd predict the sort of the successes of yesteryear. I think, unfortunately, our days of dominating the Premier League are behind us. However, I think this will probably please Tottenham fans in that I'm going to be very pessimistic and say it's not all about winning. But as we've sort of said, there's always been, at least for the last maybe 40, maybe 30 years, there's always been something else to appreciate about Arsenal. And I'm happy to be an Arsenal fan regardless of the result. I'm sure all fans of all clubs would say the same thing. It's genuinely not always about the winning. I think we've got a good chance of winning the odd cup, maybe challenging for the league if we can get the recruitment right. I mean, obviously, we're not shy of spending money. So there's no real excuse for not competing at the highest level. I think our absence from the Champions League may sadly go on for a little longer. But I think the future is bright under Arteta. I think he's a manager who, as you say, he will have learnt so much under Pep Guardiola. He will have learnt a lot under Arsene Wenger. And I think he's born from a similar kind of mould. I think he's the sort of person that Arsene Wenger would have been chuffed to know would be his successor. I don't want to talk ill of Unai Emery, because you could tell he devoted absolutely everything to the club, even though it didn't work out. But Mikel Arteta really is the sort of guy that you look at on the touchline at Arsenal and you think it just fits, it works. I think his philosophies are right. The way he talks about the game and understands the game, the way he wants to play it, and the way he sort of... He also just seems so appreciative to be Arsenal manager. And you want to find that balance between someone who is absolutely chuffed to have the opportunity to manage the club that you love, but also isn't overawed by the position. You don't want a guy who looks like he's won a competition to be there. And I think, at least for me, Arteta, he finds that balance perfectly, where I look at him and I think, yeah, he fits. He looks like an Arsenal manager. He talks like an Arsenal manager. And I'm just obviously hoping that he can follow in the footsteps of his predecessors and deliver the success that makes you think he was absolutely the right call.
Stephen, it's interesting. You know what Will says there about, you know, Arteta being the sort of manager that Wenger, you know, would hope that he's pleased is now at the helm of Arsenal Football Club. And, you know, do you think he was the right choice for the club?
I do. I think there's a potentially great manager in Mikel Arteta. I'm a great believer in how football for the top teams that win things is very much a cyclical thing. You know, you will have downtime, you will have an upturn, and the wheel will turn for Arsenal, and they'll be up there at the top again. At some point, you know, how long that takes is another matter. You know, it could be, you know, it could be next season. It could be another 5-10 seasons down the line. But what a team on the way back around that circle has to do, they first have to kind of like find the love for the game again. You know, football becomes a bit of a drudgery in a way when you know the good times end and you're looking to, you know, you paper over the cracks initially and you're looking for the quick fixes, and then eventually you do get to this point where you countenance that, no, you have to strip everything back and you have to start again. And as part of that, you've got to find that enjoyment in football, and it is winning the small battles first, and it is then making those small victories, you know, bigger. You know, you draw something together, and I've kind of sat and lived through that with Jurgen Klopp. You know, he made us fall in love with the game again at Liverpool. And I think Arsenal, Mikel Arteta can bring that kind of sensory aspect to Arsenal again. You know, to bring the joy of football back to Arsenal, and to make people fall in love with football again at Arsenal. I think he's the right man to provoke that at Arsenal.
Gary, I mean, you know, are you of a similar opinion to the other two guys? You know, do you see Arteta as being, you know, as I've said, you know, potentially a very, very good club manager, and also not only a good club manager, but he's also now at the right club in terms of his development as being the number one, if you like, having been under Guardiola for so long?
This is a difficult question because it all depends how you qualify success, how you sort of define success. Yes, I think it's a great move. Yes, I think he's steeped in the traditions of the club. Yes, I think he's had a great schooling with Guardiola. Yes, I think he'll make Arsenal play decent football. There's a big step between playing decent football and being successful in the Premier League as it is today. I think Liverpool and Man City are probably streets ahead of any other club in the Premier League. And if we're talking about successful Arteta winning the league, winning the Champions League, Arsenal a long way away from that. Whether it's we look at success of winning the cup tournament, yeah, they've got a chance of winning that. But it's a long road. It's a long road, not only for Arsenal. It's a long road for my club as well. It's a long road for Chelsea. A long road for Manchester United. It's a long road for Tottenham. But I think what Arsenal have got now, and with Arteta, I think it's massively important. And I have the same sort of feeling with Lampard at Chelsea, is that Arsenal have now got a player. A manager who understands the club, he appreciates the club, he honours the club, and he understands the club. And I think he'll make Arsenal play the football that they played under Wenger. They'll be entertaining, and if he can make them successful as well, that'll be a fantastic achievement, you know. And if he does, more power to him, because it'll be success that's earned in the right way.
Guys, you know, it's been fascinating. There's a reason why it might take us a while to decide which clubs to do, why we might have the odd little fallout as to where we should or shouldn't do certain clubs. But I think, you know, the last hour and a half has more than justified our choice of Arsenal Football Club as to get the These Football Times One Club magazine treatment. There's still time, I believe, just to get the last orders in. These magazines do, the club magazines do sell out. you know, and we often see online people, unfortunately, who've maybe failed to purchase quickly enough or just after the sold out sign goes up. But, you know, they are really, really popular. And obviously, Will, you know, you're the sub-editor to these magazines. You know, you probably have an even a better insight into how the how quickly these magazines go from, you know, sort of from the minute that they're that the topic and the subject is released online to the minute the last one's sold. I mean, you know, you'll know how popular they are.
Oh, absolutely, yeah. And I mean, I can only, it's to be expected that I'm gonna come on here and tell you how brilliant it is, because obviously it's my club and the quality of the writing from these Football Times is so established. I think what's lovely is that we see online an awful lot of the same faces. Despite the vast numbers they sell in, you still see the same faces on Twitter saying, oh, I've ordered again. And I think obviously that's an appreciation of the fact that even if they're not your club, the article's going to be in-depth, they're going to be considered and well-researched, and they're going to be written evocatively and passionately. And I think that's something obviously that everybody can appreciate. But even if I wasn't an Arsenal fan, like, this is genuinely, we say it every single time, this is one of our best yet. But the stories, it covers such a vast period of time, and it goes so in-depth with all of the people, all of the players and the managers that you would expect to read about Arsenal. And there are, from obviously my sub-editing of the magazine, there are fantastic articles. Chris Weir on Tony Adams is absolutely phenomenal. Andrew, as you said, writing about Ian Wright and David Rowcastle is an absolutely sublime piece of writing. Ian Wright's especially is a story that I could read over and have done. I've heard him tell it so many times. And every time I'm eager to hear it again. But I really don't think there's a facet of Arsenal Football Club that isn't covered in depth that Arsenal fans would fawn over and that fans of other clubs would be able to appreciate nonetheless. So I'm really proud to have been involved in it. And also I'm proud of what I wrote. I'm really pleased with my sort of my ode to Henri, if I'm allowed to sort of big myself up.
Of course you are.
But yeah, I really would I would recommend getting it because it's fantastic.
Excellent. Stephen, you know, again, another successful, you know, as Will said there, you know, another successful, after great discussion, another successful choice, another successful product. You know, and as Will's mentioned there, I mean, people buy these where I work now. You know, people are asking me, can they find out early which club we're doing next? It's like, no, I can't afford to break the TFT code. It's more than my job's worth. But it's, you know, you don't have to be a fan of Arsenal Football Club to appreciate, you know, this magazine or of any club magazine that we do.
No, you know, if you love football, then, you know, these magazines, no matter what topic we pick, you know, you're just going to love them. You know, if you, I think the people who are drawn to us are probably like-minded to us. You know, yes, Tottenham fans might steer clear of this one, just as Man United fans steer clear of the Liverpool one. And, you know, there's always going to be, you know, there's always going to be a polarising aspect to whichever club we pick. And the next one, which, you know, we're tight-lipped on, will be no exception. And yeah, but this magazine is outstanding. You know, the writing is outstanding, as all of them are. And you know, I like to think that whichever club that we do, that people can read these magazines and just you know, appreciate them all the more, appreciate the club and the histories of these clubs and the part they play in the wider scope of the game.
I mean, I suppose, Gary, you know, we've got Will on, who's an Arsenal fan, Stephen, who's a Liverpool fan, we've done their magazines. I think what Stephen's trying to say is, ultimately, it's either going to be Chelsea or Hull City next. It is what I'm reading between the lines there. Because, obviously, it would be grossly unfair for you and I to miss out on one of these one club specials. So, you know, either it's... it's sort of Grimsby Town, Scunthorpe United fans that are going to switch off, or it's going to be Fulham fans, I guess, for you, Gary, who are going to be switching off next time. But yeah. But in all seriousness, you know, it doesn't matter which club we cover, which country, which league. You know, if you're a fan of football, hopefully, you know, these magazines appeal.
I'm not letting the cat out of the bag here, but I am researching Dean Windass massively at the moment as well. No, I mean, we all have our club allegiances, but I think we all, you know, and we've said this so many times in the podcast, we're all football fans, and we can appreciate the triumphs and tribulations and the great players and the traditions of other clubs as well. You know, it's not about our club. It's about the game that we all adore, that makes us happy, that makes us cry, that makes us laugh, that makes our hearts sing and makes our spirits sink. You know, football's like a femme fatale. You know, it'll break your heart, but you'll still go back next week because, you know, it's not yours. You belong to them. And, you know, Arsenal is a great club in the history of British football, and it's right that we've done a magazine about that club. And, you know, as you mentioned earlier, and Will mentioned as well, there's so many great articles in there about the outstanding players and traditions of the club, and it'll be a great reading. To be honest with you, I can't bloody wait to get my hands on my copy as well.
Well, like I say, you know, time's against us. Will, it's been an absolute pleasure having you on. I'm a little bit gutted that it took so long to get you on, but now you're on. This could be it now. This could be a regular thing.
Yeah, I think unfortunately for the listeners, it's not going to be the last time they hear from me.
Hey, that's all right. There's absolutely nothing wrong with that. Now we've broken the duck. That's it. We're going to be getting you on for all sorts of things.
Here we go, 30th season.
Stephen, as always, thank you for joining us and contributing.
Oh, joy is always, Stu. Absolutely a brilliant way to spend 90 minutes.
and Gary, you know, Stephen said there, I guess, it's kind of just what we do, isn't it? We just mates chatting about football, really.
Yeah, there's nothing better than sort of sitting with your mates talking about football. And I've got a beer as well here, so that's just kept off the evening as well. So it's been a great hour and a half or so, and here's the next one, mate.
That's it. All that's left for me to say is I'm sorry you left early, Tottenham fans. Arsenal fans, I hope you enjoyed it. Like I say, there's still a little bit of time left to order the magazine, but, you know, again, thank you for joining us. And please join us again next time on the Lob Podcast with These Football Times. Thank you and goodbye.
Many thanks for joining us today on the Lob, a These Football Times production. For more of our content, check out our award-winning print magazine featuring some of the game's foremost writers, artists and photographers, exploring areas of the game rarely covered in high-end print. For now, we look forward to you joining us again soon.